everybody. Thank you for coming to this, what I think will be a fascinating panel discussion on democratisation, European integration and identity. We usually start LSE events at 5 past the hour, but as all of you have shown up on time, coming in, welcome. My name is Claire Gordon, and in case you're wondering why the head of the LSE Teaching and Learning Centre is chairing this event, I'm not entirely an imposter, just a little bit. I spent 10 years working in the European Institute, and my area of expertise in my academic career focused on EU enlargement and conditionality, and did quite a lot of work on Eastern Europe and the Western Balkans, so I'm really delighted to be here tonight, and I'm looking forward to our three presentations. The sort of focus really of today is around public opinion really and attitude change, and we're going to be focusing on three fundamental questions. How do attitudes change across public opinion? How do attitudes towards migrants relate to the process of EU integration? And how and why does the effect of the recent crisis differ between countries? And I think it's a really opportune moment given the degree of flux and uncertainty in Europe at the moment to have a look at, drill down into what's going on in terms of public opinion. So what I'm going to do is introduce our panel members one by one, and I'm going to ask them to speak for about 10 to 12 minutes. And we're going to take, they're going to speak one after the other, and then we're going to have a lot of time for questions and discussion. So listen carefully, prepare your questions, come in. And I think we're going to have a really interesting discussion. So first of all, I'd like to open the floor to Dr. Charlotte Galpin, who's lecturing German and European politics at the University of Birmingham. And she's going to be presenting a paper on the Euro crisis and European identities, political and media discourse in Germany, Ireland and Poland. Charlotte, if you want to say anything else about who you are and your background, please feel free to do so.
Okay, I think you said the important things.
Great.
Okay, so I'll start.
Yeah,
okay, thank you. Firstly, thanks to Simona and to Alexandra for the invitation and the organisation, and to LSEE for hosting this event. What I'm going to do is present my book, which was published in the last few months, on the impact of the Euro crisis on European identities, which hopefully can then speak to the other papers which look at other crises and processes of public opinion change. My starting point with the book was in 2010, where the kind of Euro crisis was starting, and there were a lot of debates, particularly in Germany, about the Greek bailout. And one thing that was being discussed was whether this had was representing a shift in Germany's relationship with Europe and its kind of commitment to the European project. And so it was kind of perceived as this kind of significant critical juncture for European identity. So that's the kind of starting point of the research. The main argument of the book, however, is that the Euro crisis actually has relatively minimal effects on the meaning of European identity in different countries. Rather, it's actually the lens, European identities are actually the lens through which we understand the crisis, the implications of the crisis, and potential solutions. And what I argue is that political and media actors act strategically in making sense of the crisis in order to legitimize their crisis policies in their respective national contexts, and then also opposition actors and media actors kind of use also identities to contest policies. So what happens is then that European identities become central to the legitimization and contestation of but the crisis actually becomes part of the identity discourse that it's expected to change. So I'll very quickly give an overview of the theoretical framework. So I'm taking a social constructivist approach to European identity. So the idea that European identities are socially constructed through communication, through discourse about the European Union, that constructs particular narratives, meanings of what being European means and what it means to be European and where the boundaries of Europe lie. But this doesn't mean that there's kind of one European identity, but that national identities become Europeanized through this kind of process of communication. But that means that there can be significant differences between countries, and that some countries may not develop a kind of Europeanized national identity. So what we're really talking about is multiple European identities, that there are kind of multiple understandings of what it means to be European. So according to this understanding of identity, European identity is then quite difficult to change. So there's a kind of path dependence in identities that limits possibility of change, limits political and media actors to change what European identity means in particular contexts. But the idea is that they can change at moments of crisis, at moments of critical junctures. And the scholars working on this kind of argue that identity can change if the crisis kind of clashes with existing notions of identity, if it does not resonate in that context. And that this would create then a window of opportunity for actors to change meanings. But what exactly happens at these moments of crisis is not really clearly understood. It's kind of acknowledged that that crises will not automatically or not necessarily lead to identity change, but it depends very much on context and how the crisis is perceived. So then my argument is that actually to understand the potential for discursive change, we need to understand how the crisis itself is perceived and how it's constructed. So just as there are multiple Europes, multiple European identities, then there are also multiple crises, kind of constructions of crisis. So what I'm doing is looking at how the crisis was constructed in different contexts, and what that means then for European identities. And the idea is that then political and media actors construct crises strategically to make sense of events to justify their policy decisions. What's important when it comes to EU crises is that this isn't just about negotiating policy responses, but it's also about the polity. So in the context of the euro crisis, these debates were often about further sharing of sovereignty in the European Union, changing the fundamental makeup of the European Union in terms of economic governance. So when it comes to these kind of debates, it very much comes down to, in terms of the European crisis, about rationales for European integration. Why are countries, how do countries justify the further sharing of sovereignty and what Europe in this context means? So what happens then is that in the context of the European crisis, these debates turn into debates about the meaning of Europe itself. So what I do in the book then is look at political and media discourse in three countries. I'll firstly talk a bit about the countries. So I have three case studies, Germany, Ireland, and Poland. And I chose these countries aren't necessarily, aren't usually kind of compared. And but why I found these countries really interesting with regards to the euro crisis is they represent three countries that have quite different experiences of the crisis. So obviously you have Germany, which was one of the main creditor states, taking a leading role in negotiating the bailout agreements. We have Ireland, obviously one of the debtor countries that was very clearly affected by the crisis. And then Poland is a new member state and not a Eurozone member, but at the time, it's treaty bound officially to join the Euro, and at the time still committed to joining the Euro. So we look at political speeches media discourse, looking at tabloids, two broadsheet newspapers in each country and one tabloid. And I'm looking very much at the early stage of the crisis. So 2010, when the first Greek bailout was agreed, and at the end of 2011, around the time of the European Council summit, when the fiscal compact was agreed. So I'm not going to describe all of my findings, but I firstly wanted to give an outline of the German case, and then maybe a little bit about Poland to feed in with the other papers on this panel, but I might skip past that very quickly. So for the German case, just some background, there are two kind of strands of elite discourse on the EU in Germany. One relates to Germany's post-war European identity, where commitment to European integration and to a set of European values, kind of reconciliation, democracy and human rights, were kind of constructed as a way to overcome the past and to prove its commitment to a peaceful Europe. But then we also have a kind of discourse on ordoliberalism, which is Germany's version of neoliberalism, which is based on a set of values to do with monetary stability, individual responsibility, fiscal discipline. And so in the late 80s, early 90s, we had this idea of the European stability community, which was used to justify Germany joining the Eurozone. So in Germany, what we have in the crisis discourse is, the crisis is constructed very much as an existential threat to Europe. So this is not just about the Eurozone, but actually the future of the European integration project. And a quote by Merkel in 2010 sums that up quite well when she says that if the Euro fails, it's it will be the idea of European unification that fails. And in the media also you have references to the founding fathers, so-called founding fathers of the EU, and Germany's historical responsibilities to maintain the European project and to continue the Franco-German relationship in the context of the crisis. But at the same time you have this discourse on ordoliberal values, which feeds into a particular understanding of the good European. Here the good European is someone that exercises fiscal discipline, individual responsibility in economic matters. And that's linked very much to this post-war commitment to European integration. But what happens then is that this often translates into a kind of exclusive Northern European community. So Greece and kind of idea of Southern Europe come to represent the bad Europeans. So this is draws on the interpretation of the crisis that lays the blame with these countries. So Greece was a country that did not comply with EU rules. It did not exercise does not maintain a deficit according to the Stability and Growth Pact. So these are the bad Europeans, and that's then it's used to justify the possibility of Greece leaving the Eurozone, and also to call for implementation of austerity measures. But what this means is that regardless of kind of where you stand on the political spectrum in Germany, European identity is still central to the public legitimation and contestation of the EU. So it's not about being European or not being European, but about what the European community is taken to mean and where its boundaries are seen to lie. I'm going to skip past the Polish case and just maybe we can talk a bit about that later. But just to talk about some how we can apply this to the EU and public opinion after the crisis. So firstly, I think this really shows that European identity discourses are sticky, they're very difficult to change, and they're strongly informed by historical memory. So particularly with Poland and also in the Irish case, these discourses kind of precede the European Union, but they are kind of translated into that context by political leaders. European identities really shape how European crises are understood, and they're used strategically by political and media actors to legitimize or contest policy responses, but also in debates about further integration. But what I want to point out is that this kind of resilience in the meaning of European identity does not mean that the crises don't have an impact. But what I would argue is that it's these kind of competing conceptions of Europe that can strengthen divisions in Europe, because particular understandings of European identity aren't always compatible across countries. And I think I would also say that this helps to explain the UK context feeds into the Brexit debate. I guess that's all I'd say. I have flyers with discount codes if anyone's interested, and the book here as well. Thank you,
Charlotte. Thank you very much. I'm sure that if people have questions about Poland or that sort of tantalising reference to the UK, which some of us are very interested in, we can raise them in the discussion afterwards. And it will be very interesting to see if the sort of hypotheses and that you put forward based on your research have any resonance with the other two papers. So we're going to turn now to Alexandra. Yes? So while they switch positions, I'll say a little bit about Alexandra, and I'm going to now crucify the pronunciation of the Department of Social Science at the University Carlos III in Madrid, that she's working at as the Juan de la Cierva, postdoctoral fellow. And before that, she was a visiting fellow at the Minder de Gunzburg Center for European Studies at Harvard University. If she wants to say more about where she's coming from, she can do that when she starts her presentation. She's going to be looking at the limits of diversity in European unity, European identification, and preference for internal migration. So thank you very much. And
thank you so much, Claire. And thanks so much for coming to listen to this talk. And also thanks so much to Alexandra and the Center for organizing and hosting this event. I'm very, very happy to be here at this table with fellow researchers who I really admire and I really like their work, so I'm really excited about that. As Claire said, I'm currently at the Carlos III University in Spain, but what I'm going to talk about today is actually the result of a postdoctoral project that I developed last year while in residence at the Center for European Studies at Harvard University. This was actually thought as a project that very nicely complements what Charlotte was talking about, because in the project I wanted to look at how European identification has been affected by the recent crisis. I have worked on the topic for a few years now, and I thought that this moment was a good time to actually see whether anything has changed in the result of the recent challenges towards European integration. So just to introduce the topic and maybe explain a little bit the link to international migration. We know that international migration challenges the self-definition of national communities. However, in Europe, this becomes a little bit more complex since we are faced in the European Union with this supranational level of identification. And actually, as the United in Diversity motto indicates, difference is a constitutive element of identity. So I was interested in looking at how this element has changed, or whether it has changed during the recent crisis. Specifically, I was looking at the time before and after the so-called refugee migrant crisis has become a topic that the media have covered very broadly. And another element that needs to be taken into account is that we know that the idea of European identity, European identification, is this idea of a cosmopolitan identity that goes beyond nations, that goes beyond the national differences. However, an identity always needs a demarcation, always needs another, always needs a community that has borders, that has limits to make it actually a meaningful category of reference for the people who identify with that. So I wanted to look at that in the context of migration within and from the outside of the European Union. And here we have actually two kinds of migration, mainly the internal migration, or you might say the mobile European citizens, so the free movement within the European Union, versus those who come from the outside of the Union. And in the current context, actually, we have seen several issues, several challenges to European integration that have put this issue at the center. On the one hand, the so-called refugee migrant crisis. On the other hand, we have seen the politicization of free movement within the Union with the Brexit debate. So I think I'm in the right place to not to have explained anything further about that. But the effect on European political opinion is this one. And this is a graph from the recent Eurobarometer. You can see that while during the economic crisis, unemployment and the economic situation were main issues that the Europeans saw as challenges to Europe or to the European Union, in the recent years, since 2015, actually migration is perceived as the main challenge for the European Union. So in this context, this is the context for my study, and I wanted to look at how attitudes towards migration changed in that particular period. And I hope you can see something. Sorry, this looks really not very well here, but you can see that this is the share of people who have favorable view of internal migrants. I call internal migrants mobile EU citizens, so the people that move within the EU. So you can see that the share of people who have a favorable view of internal migrants have actually gone up since 2014, while the share of people who have a favorable view of external migrants, so non-EU citizens who come to Europe looking for different reasons, economic migrants, but probably under the idea of non-EU migration, probably people also include refugees and all kinds of different migrants, also maybe the nationality of the migrants can be thought of differently depending on the country that the question is asked in, depending on what kind of migrant influx this country has received. But in general, you can see that the level of tolerance for external migration is actually pretty low. It has gone down a little bit with the crisis, and then we see that the difference to view of internal migrants is quite big, and it has actually become bigger in the recent years. And this is where my study comes in. I want to look at the preference for internal migration. So independently of whether you think migration is a good or a bad thing, whether you like migrants or not, I want to look at people who actually have a more favorable attitude of towards European migrants than the non-European migrants. That's what I call preference for internal migration. And in previous studies, actually there's one study from 2001 that looks at this question, and Lauren McLaren, she concludes that there is no European collective identity because actually people, if they don't like migration, they don't like any kind of migrants, and if they think migrants are okay, they don't care whether they are European or non-European. So I challenged this assumption in my paper, and I showed that it has actually changed, especially following 2015. And here you can see another graph that actually shows some evidence for that. You can see that this is the share of people who actually have the same view of internal and external migration, so it doesn't matter if you ask them about EU citizens or non-EU citizens, and you can see that this share has gone down significantly. So while over 60% in 2014 thought that they had the same kind of attitude, in 2016 it's actually more like 50%. So still a majority, but there has been a significant drop. While we see that the share of people who have a more significant attitude towards internal migrants than external migrants has significantly increased. So I try to look at how this growing preference for internal migration is related to EU integration, whether it's related at all, and also how it's related to the idea of European collective identity. And in my theoretical framework, I actually look at and that's a big difference from Charlotte's research. I look at European identification as a personally rooted attitude or preference or opinion. And I use the social identity theory, and that theory actually from social psychology tells us that we need some kind of boundaries between in and out groups for the cognitive process of identification to actually happen. And we also know, however, that because European identification is a superordinate identity, it actually contributes to greater tolerance towards diversity. So there is this tension, there is this contradiction. And I specifically look at the relationship here to European identification, and from previous research, and there's a lot of research about that topic, there's no a single theory of European identification, but one thing that scholars agree upon is that European identification is compatible in principle with national identification. So I take this and I actually look at different kinds of configurations of European and national identification, whether national is the first frame of reference or European, and whether there's only one type of identification or people combine two types. So we have these four categories, and in parentheses, you see the share actually of people who in recent Eurobarometer data recognize to holding one of those types of identification. You can see that actually this national and European type of identity configuration is the most popular or the most widespread in Europe currently with 53%. So let me show you some results. I try to verify the hypothesis that if one identifies as national and European, so national first, because national is the frame of reference and national identities tend to be more bounded, more well-defined than the European one, then these people also have a stronger preference for internal migration, because there will be a kind of projection of the way national identity is configured to the European one. Well, probably people who hold European as the first one will not be significantly more in favor of internal migrants. So this is a bit about my data and the methods. I basically used Eurobarometer data between 2014 and 2016, and let me show you some results. These are the results. Yeah, also still, data graphs, not great for this projector, I don't know why. But this is what interests us. Among the people who identify as national and European, you can see that actually the gap is biggest between those that say that they are favorable towards internal migration and those that say that external migration is okay. So actually, we see already some indication that the hypothesis might be true, that there is a difference for the national and European identifiers. And when we look at the preference for internal migration, we see, again, that there is a difference for the national European types of identifiers. This is the only group where there's no clear majority of people who actually think that internal and external migrants are the same or they have the same kind of attitudes. So I further verify these findings in more sophisticated models, and I control for all a host of other explanatory frameworks, also contextual variables. I take into account, for instance, the number of migrants from the outside of the EU and from within the EU that come to every country, etc. I control for different economic variables, and these are the results. And basically, I want you to focus on the green green part of the graph. You see the different configurations of identity, and you can see that national and European has a positive and significantly positive effect on preference for European or internal migration in the European Union. So that would verify my hypothesis that expects these people to be significantly more positive of internal migration than external migration. And I further check this to prove the robustness of the findings by including the attachment variable. So I check controlling for level of attachment to country as well as the European Union and Europe, whether these results hold. These results do hold. You can still see that there is a significantly positive effect of national and European identification. And what is very interesting here is also that people who actually have a greater attachment to Europe tend to prefer or value more migrations from within Europe than from outside, but it's not the same for those who are attached to the European Union. So it seems it indicates a relationship, the more kind of cultural idea of Europe and the cultural element of a component of identity. And I further tested in single country models, and this actually also ties in very nicely with what Charlotte was talking about, because we find that European identity discourses and national identity discourses are very, very important. And we can see that this relationship holds in most of European countries, but not all of them, and in some is stronger than in others. So my data, unfortunately, does not allow me to explore this as a case-by-case kind of study. That would be a study for probably a discourse, elite discourse, public media discourse, etc. But we can see that there is broad evidence for the fact that holding a national and European identification is associated with preference for internal migration. However, it's dependent on the context. So some conclusions. There are some limitations to the study. This is cross-sectional data, so I'm actually comparing people over time. I don't have panel data to say that during the refugee and migrant crisis, people have changed in such a way. This is more of a study to see the relationship between European identity and attitudes towards migration, and I cannot really make an argument about causality and change within individuals. And also, we can talk about it in the Q&A, who are the European, who are the non-European migrants. I think it's important to talk about how maybe these questions are very reductive and maybe do not represent the whole spectrum of different kinds of perceptions of migration in Europe. However, I would argue that if we find an effect, there is good evidence for the importance of this general distinction. If actually this distinction is meaningful for the people in Europe, then there is something to it. Obviously, depending on the context as well, as I showed in the previous slide. So just to sum up, national European identification, these are the people who actually tend to prefer more internal migrants over external migration. It's also correlated both to some civic elements. I didn't have time to talk about it, but like more EU knowledge or support for free movement are positively correlated with preference for internal migration, but also cultural elements, as we have seen, not attachment to the European Union, but to Europe as a more kind of broad geographical idea. And I've already talked about the importance of national context. So just to sum up, I would say that this is, I think this is very interesting, mostly because there's an assumption that fostering European identification within the European Union will solve a lot of issues, but we have seen from this studies that, for instance, greater tolerance towards non-European migrants might not necessarily go hand in hand with a stronger European identification. So that will be something for the policymakers to consider. So Thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to your questions.
Good to go from case studies to a big N number study, or at least a bigger N number study. So our final speaker is Dr. Simona Guerra. I think it's Simona that we have to thank for this very interesting panel discussion here tonight. She's currently a visiting fellow at LISI, the research on Southeast Europe Centre here in the European Institute. And in her spare time, she's Associate Professor in Politics at the School of History, Politics and International Relations at the University of Leicester, and also acting as the head of school, so she has a few things going on in her life at the moment. But nonetheless, she's found the time to come and share with us her research on democratisation and European integration, and looking at how attitudes towards the EU change, and the place of religion, I think, in that. So thanks, Simona.
Many thanks to you all. Many thanks to the LSE and Alexandra for organizing tonight. And I'm sorry I haven't spent more time on my research fellowship here. I had planned well in advance to spend at least 4 days a week. And when I'm able to spend at least 2 days a week, I'm really, really happy. So this is a very, very, very happy week, because I'm going to be here on Monday and on Friday. In my paper today, it was the starting point of my research fellowship and the starting point of my research. The underlying main research question in my research is how attitudes change. Most of the times we look at case studies and looking at a particular moment in time and what determinants and how determinants affect attitudes. My main research interest instead is looking at how these attitudes may change and how determinants of attitudes may change. And in particular, my interest is looking at candidate countries and how attitudes change before and after joining the European Union. So how expectations are met and how determinants might change. That was the main research question on my PhD and my following research. And what I found interesting in my research at the time was that I was mainly looking at the economic dimension, looking at post-communist countries and looking at the way that the relative poverty of the communist time and then what it could mean also in terms of possible benefits overall of accession, I posited more interest in looking at the cost-benefit ratio and how this could affect attitudes towards the European Union. However, when I was measuring also social demographic factors, I found that the position of religion could change in a country like Poland, where possibly Catholicism has a very important position. So in the book that I sought to complete while being here, but I got at least 4 chapters out of 6, and I still have 4 weeks before Christmas. I'm looking at the way that religion may affect attitudes also in the Western Balkans, and looking at the way that it drives attitudes and how they drive attitudes and what type of narratives may emerge across in religious institutions, and whether these religious institutions may try to channel their own narrative within the social and political debates by, for instance, using an alliance with a particular political party, as, for instance, it has happened in Poland, but also, for instance, in Croatia or in Serbia. So in my presentation, I'm going to skip a bit, because I think I have about 6 minutes, if we think about half an hour, and look at the way that, looking also at democratization and how democratization affects attitudes towards the European Union and the role of religion, looking just at Poland and looking a bit at the Southeastern European area, as it is our research interest. Looking at the frameworks of analysis that I use in order to answer my question, I look at the 5 main theories to explain attitudes. So in my PhD, I mainly look at the utilitarian rationality one. But if you look at how we explain attitudes towards the European Union and like a sort of replication of Gabel's study when he was using the 5 main theories, the 5 main theories look at cognitive mobilization, the high levels of education, more interest for politics, make us more aware of the policy-making process, and therefore will make us more supportive of the integration process. The link between political parties and public opinion, which I didn't find, for instance, at the time, very workable for the post-communist region, because of high levels of distrust towards political parties as also sort of legacy with the previous regime. The utilitarian rationality ones that can be split in a social, tropic, and egocentric type of variable, where you can think that joining the European Union is benefiting your country or is going to benefit in yourself and your own household, or national identity that have been largely explored in the previous papers, or the influence of the domestic situation. So if I look at Poland and looking at attitudes before joining the European Union, in my research I split attitudes across three different times. So the first one is the one up to 98-99. Poland opened the negotiation process in the spring of 99, and up to then attitudes have always been very high, around 75-77% of support. All of a sudden, then between 91 and 2001, we have a sudden drop, and in the literature, Poland is indicated the country with the most dramatic change of all the countries they joined in 2004 and 2007. And this happened also because there is a disagreement between me and my PhD supervisor, Alex Shobia, where I find that there is a sort of causal relationship between the reforms, the huge reforms that were asked to Poland at the time. There was a new government and reforms that were in a way implemented in the administrations, but also in the education. In 2001, I was studying in Poland and I was suggested to go back home if I needed, for instance, the hospital to see a doctor. So there were different reforms at different levels, and there was huge disappointment towards this sort of social backlash due to the reforms. And then between 2001 and 2004, when in a way people could see the enlargement and could see that they were nearing accession, there was a sort of idea that there was no other alternative and it was the only great opportunity that they had. So in the end, it was good to join the European Union, but if we look at levels of opposition, they were still about 20%, the highest, together with the ones that you had in the years of where you had less support for the European Union, and never went as down as they were in the early 90s. So people had clear that they were supporting the European Union, but still you had high levels of opposition, one-fifth of the population. After accession instead, we find, these are data from CEBOS, that is the Center on Public Opinion Research in Poland. I generally use national data, which I find more reliable compared to the Eurobarometer data. And generally, they give me different types of levels of support. Generally, I find much higher levels of support in the EU Eurobarometer data. So I generally rely on national data. And after accession, I find that levels of support have always been around 80%. And levels of oppositions have been always quite low. Just around 2012-2013, there is a higher level of opposition that probably then has impacted in the change in 2015 and with the new peace government, law and justice government. So what I do in my research, I look at the different frameworks of analysis that I present here. And my expectations is that political cues are not very important or not very explanatory in the case of Poland before accession, but also after joining the European Union. I was expecting also that cognitive mobilization because of the post-communist environment could not be very significant. One is that I was expecting that the utilitarian model, also as I had tested just that in my PhD, could be the most explanatory in the case of Poland. And national identity, as it was mobilized before joining the European Union by the League of Polish Families, I thought it could be explanatory before accession and then after accession. And then looking at the domestic proxies, I was expecting that the direction of the country could be negative before joining the European Union, where you are dissatisfied following Sanchez-Cuenca type of framework, where you are dissatisfied of the performance of your national institutions, you are generally more supportive of the EU integration process because you think that joining the European Union is going to benefit your country. So what I have done in my research, and I have my tables here, sorry, no, my tables are in my pen. Is it in my pen?
It's on the desktop just over there.
Ah, yes. Okay, so I didn't, if you can see them, I'll try to show you my tables from here. Can you see them? Not much. Then I move the table. So what I've done, I've used a binary logistic regression on whether people were supporting the European Union and would have voted yes in a possible referendum both before and after joining the European Union. And what I have found, I found that church attendance, I used being believer in my PhD, I used church attendance in this case, as in the case of Poland, for instance, I had always the question that most of the people, more than 90%, were believers. So using church attendance was significant at the aggregate level, and actually it is significant also at the individual level, where the more you attend the religious service, the less you support the European Union. I find that there is also a correlation on the left-right dimension, where on the left you are more supportive of the EU, but the most important variables were the one of the case of cognitive mobilization and interest in politics, and in this case the materialist, post-materialist values is a question on supporting order, where it goes in opposition, and therefore post-materialist values would link with support for the European Union. At the level of the rational utilitarian, there was the idea before joining the European Union in the narrative, in the generally social narrative, that would have benefited the country, but actually looking at the individual level here, I have that people would think that they were going to benefit from EU accession. And then national identity is the one that is one of the most important, where Polish independence is negatively linked to support to European integration, but feeling European instead is one that is most significant. And similarly, the one on democratization, where satisfaction for democracy is one that correlates with support for the European Union. So thinking that the country is moving towards the right direction and be satisfied with the democracy was significant for support towards the European Union. Looking instead after joining the European Union, and these are Polish national election studies before and after joining the European Union, I find that church attendance is still significant, less than before, but church attendance is negatively linked to support for the European Union. So there is this space for opposition towards the European Union structured around a religious narrative. And as Ljaszewicz said, it doesn't mean that it is significant and determinant, but there is something there that can emerge as opposition towards the European Union. And looking then at community mobilization, again, here I have the education variable that I didn't have in the previous data set, and I find that the higher the levels of education that I found also at the aggregate level, the highest the level of support. While the economic situation has completely changed, both for Poland and for the material household, the material situation of the household, and both are very significant. Similarly, feeling European is the one that on the Polish national election studies is the most significant, and still satisfaction with democracy and the way that the present political situation is doing is one that is significant with support for the European Union. So, overall, but skipping on what I found as now I have enlarged it. Not yet. So I need to just continue. Yeah. I skip the discussion where I found that the process of democratization is not negatively impacting on attitudes towards the European Union, where I found that there is still a mixture that I have found between affective and utilitarian dimensions, and the economic voting is always significant, in particular after joining the European Union, both at the country and the egocentric level at the personal level. What I'm doing now in my book, I'm looking at the Western Balkans, and I've been looking at Croatia because I was expecting that it was a very similar case compared to Poland for what had happened, and I have a minute, for what had happened in Croatia after joining the European Union. And despite, in a way, the Croatian Democratic Union has used a religious narrative of the way that till Tudjman was alive, there was this idea, the Catholic Church close to the leader and close to the Croatian Democratic Union, I found that the two didn't go well together on affecting attitudes towards the European Union, and on the contrary, what I have found in the case of Croatia is that religious attitudes are positive towards European integration. So looking at studies that have been done by Guth and Nelson, it correlates and can be explanatory within this type of studies. If I look instead at the case of Serbia, I find that it's the narrative that is the closest to Poland. So the Orthodox Church as well is one that is constructed vis-a-vis Western civilization and against Western civilization. And it's also constructed at the national level. In this way, it can, in a way, be constructed and reinforcing and strengthening the national identity. In studies that have been done previously by Eric Gordy, for instance, he found that there was a type of democratization process that was led more towards a sort of national authoritarianism, where it was strengthening national identity, and where there was also a refusal of the past, where it was used a sort of denial type of discourse, where the persecutors becomes the victim, and therefore you refuse the past, and you see also a sort of rejection for Europe for what Serbia had done, for instance, in the battle of Kosovo in the 14th century. And this is my interest in looking at whether it won't become determinant in types of studies looking at attitudes towards the European Union. So in my research, what I found that when in the literature in the before joining the big enlargement, the fifth enlargement, there were studies that were looking at mainly attitudes at that time and were saying, well, look at the way they may change over time. I've looked at whether they change over time and I found that they do change over time. It seems the domestic political situation is affecting attitudes. Satisfaction towards democracy is the most significant. But also I find that in the long term, dissatisfaction towards political elites can affect a reaction towards mainstream political parties, as this has happened in Poland recently. And in particular, in with regard to religion, we need to look at how predominant the religion is. And sociologists, for instance, are talking about cases where religion becomes more religion, and whether this is encapsulated within national identity and can become a challenge for the process of European integration. For a sort of ambiguous dimension of religion, where on one side moves towards a collective community, and on the other instead is against the other. So then the case of Poland offers other interesting observations, and my interest is looking at the comparative perspective and what is happening in the Western Balkans now. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. So we've got time for, we've got just over half an hour time for discussion. I think there's some very interesting parallels, similarities, and also different areas of focus in the three papers that perhaps you can bring out in terms of the discussion. Certainly there's a Polish fault line running through some of the papers. But what I'm going to do is let's open up the floor. Maybe we'll take two or three questions at the same time. Please, can you introduce yourself, because you know who the panel is, but we don't know who you are. And also, perhaps, if you're addressing your question to a particular one of the speakers, can you make that clear? So who would like to kick off our discussion this evening? Should we start here? Yeah, thanks.
Yes, yes. Hi, I'm Isabel Hurtner. I'm at King's College next door. And I absolutely love the three presentations. And I have a question for Alexandra and one for Simona. So for Alexandra, I was wondering if you have data on whether people prefer certain types of EU migrants over others. That's at least the impression I got in context of Brexit. And also the same applying to the third country nationals, that some migrants are more welcome than others, unfortunately. And for Simona, I found that really interesting, that in Poland, church attendance and Euroscepticism go hand in hand. And how can that be when there's so much research on the EU being a Christian democratic project and the Catholic Church being such an internationalist organization? So I have no idea how you can explain it.
Okay, Sharice? Yeah.
Sabina Pachalis, PhD candidate at Queen Mary. My question is for Simona. I don't know whether I didn't understand right or you were in a rush in terms of time, but you mentioned that denial syndrome and then the Battle of Kosovo in the 14th century. So do you connect the denial syndrome to that battle?
Leap,
so
yes.
Could you expand on that one?
Yeah.
And how it relates to EU identity.
Yes. I'm going to take one more question over there.
Yes, I am Misha Gavrilovic, a native of Belgrade. I hope you know where that is. It was Yugoslavia, now in Serbia, etc., etc. It is the only capital in the world that has been bombed by both NATO and the Nazis. I know this is also an identity. And I have a big problem with this word Europeanization. I mean, Europe is a continent. We know where it lies. If you're not in Europe, then you must be in Asia or Africa, right? And here we have, so Europe has been around since time immemorial, at least as a landmass. But here you've got EU, which has been around just for over 20 years. And we are supposed to have this European identity, which is basically the rich man's club of Europe, deciding what it should be and what it shouldn't be. And there was here Simona Guerra telling us Serbian Orthodox Church is against Europeanization, whatever it means.
No.
Serbian Orthodox Church is being bombed by NATO, I should tell you. And here we have the United States. In the recent war, 90 NATO countries have bombed the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, and that included 14 members of the EU countries. So I don't think you should hide by these words, Europeanization and so on. We know who's bombed, we know who hasn't bombed, and we know that basically one of the biggest things about Europe is it's the effect of a non-European power, a superpower, which does a great deal, by the way, in controlling Europe. I mean, just about all of the EU countries have been in Afghanistan. I don't know what they do. I know this is a difficult issue to raise, but please, there is a European continent. It lies between the Atlantic and the Urals, and it's going from the North Pole right up to the Mediterranean. Is Moscow in Europe or is it in Asia?
Okay, I think we've got an interesting question there about EU versus European identity. Okay, so who would like to go first? Charlotte, do you want to start?
I'm not sure if there was much there that I would pick up on, but I would at least say with the Europeanization, I think it's important to distinguish sometimes between, that there can be a difference between Europeanization and kind of EUization, and European identity does not necessarily mean identification with the EU and identification as kind of political, this political identity. So, and at least in my case, sometimes these European discourses have definitely preceded or draw on historical narratives that precede the European Union. So.
Thank you, Simone.
Thanks a lot. On levels of attendance and why they do not correlate with more levels of support, and actually Gustav Nelson said that generally Catholic people, they say quotation are warmer towards the European integration process, and that has always been the same across the countries, also because of sort of blueprint of the European People's Party, where the great fathers of the European Union at the time, Monet, were all people who were in a way bringing values that were within the Christian Democratic Party, but also were type of Catholic values, underlying Catholic values. What is interesting to me actually is why it doesn't work in some countries. Mm-hmm. And the explanations I give is that in a way it's not the mainstream church, but it's a more like a sort of extreme church. In the case of Poland, it is the church that is led by Father Rigic, and it's not the mainstream church in Poland. And what has happened? It has happened that it has emerged, having given more voice to the radio, to the newspapers, having also some schools that are actually quite supported at the financial level by the current government, has supported and given more space to some political leaders. At the time, it was the League of the Polish Families that was more or less the voice of 2 million people, generally rural people from the eastern part of Poland, or young people from young people movements that sometimes we are still seeing and we have seen recently, and Alexandra has written about it recently as well. And what has happened is that they have made salient some issues that were important for these people. At the time for them, it was important the position of Poland towards the European Union. So they had this idea, what does this European Union want? We are different, or we want to protect our own national independence. Till yesterday we were under Moscow, and now we're selling ourselves to Brussels. And generally then the voice of this radio, the voice of this church, of this newspaper, Naschenik at the time, and these political leaders, there is a channel where they can, in a way, voice their opposition, both through the church and through the political party. When they didn't give any longer support to the political party, they exited the League of Polish Families and started to support Law and Justice. And this is the way the law and justice is getting more and more support across some particular shares of citizens. With regard to the case of Serbia, Sabrina Rame has extensively written about the Orthodox Church, and I didn't say the quotation. I was reflecting on the church and the position of the church towards European integration. I don't use even Europeanization in my research. I generally talk about democratization or European integration. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the question, Isabel. And I think it's a very good one and a very pertinent one. And I wish I had the data, of course. I don't have it, unfortunately. But if we think about, obviously, how people respond to a question about how do you feel about other EU citizens coming to your country to work, it very much depends. Even if we only ask about the EU citizens, it depends on the context of the country. And I live in Spain right now, and obviously we have, for instance, a lot of Romanian migrants, and probably their perception, the social perception, is much closer to the non-EU citizens than, for instance, the so-called British expats who go to retire to Costa del Sol. So there's much, obviously, heterogeneity within these categories, and even if we think about the external migrants, of course, there are many, many different kinds of perceptions that could be conflated within this very broad category, and especially there could be many differences across countries. So I think it very much depends on what also Charlotte was talking about, the historical effect of or how the community, national community has been built. For instance, empire building, history of linguistic and cultural ties with different parts of the world. Also the conflation between economic migrants and refugees, all of that I think it's very problematic, and I acknowledge it in that study, and I wish I had data that could actually test in different countries how different groups are perceived. Unfortunately, I don't have this data right now. I wish maybe soon, I don't know, there could be a big project, but obviously that needs a lot of money, a lot of funding to do that. But I think this is a very good question, and I wish I could have an answer to actually say how the difference works, the difference works between countries. However, I think I want to reiterate what I said before in my presentation. The mere fact that this distinction actually works is indicative of that there is some meaning to the community of Europeans, right? Because even in spite of such a big heterogeneity within these categories that are very broad, that can mean anything to in different countries and to different people, it still works, and there are still significant facts in relation to European identity variables. So I think that for itself speaks as an indication that there is something to it. I wish I could explore it further. And I wanted to say something to what Simona was saying before about the role of the church in Poland, if I may. I haven't said that in my presentation. I'm actually Polish, so I'm very much interested also in Polish politics, and I also work on Cyprus in Europe. So I wanted to ask Simona actually about the change of the effect of the church attendance, because I know that a very important factor surrounding the referendum on membership was a deal supposedly struck between the government and the church agreeing on not touching the abortion law in exchange for a more positive coverage, so to speak, on part of the church in the masses and in their interaction with the Polish public. And I heard a lot of commentators say that was definitive to the actually the victory in the membership referendum. So I wonder, so there might also be some maybe positive impact, but maybe more difficult to measure and verify. But I wonder if you have seen anything that could be indicative of that. So yeah.
Also,
So let's use that as the starting point for another set of questions. And maybe I'll sort of, if I could pitch in there. What strikes me, and maybe I misunderstood Simone, your paper, but what I find really surprising is actually the incredibly high levels of support for the EU post-accession. And I think, and that to me is deeply surprising, because actually the reality of the lived experience of being a member of the European Union may not live up to the expectations that people had pre-accession. And actually, to me, that is the big story here, that between 80-90%, that sort of constant between 80-90% of people supporting the European Union. And after a little wobble, when Law and Justice came to power, that has remained the same. So that would be my question for you. For Charlotte, it would be great if you could sort of pitch in a bit of your own research on Poland, and it would be interesting to hear how your findings about Germany, how they play out in the Polish context. And maybe a quick question for Alexandra too, to sort of, if we could delve deeper into what you've just said about that internal, external migrants divide. And of course, having lived my life as a sort of more qualitative political scientist, I sort of want to know the whys as much as the sort of what the data tells us. And so it is very interesting that this sort of division you pick up between the support for internal migrants and external migrants, and you relate that to something to do with the culture of Europe. But I find that quite interesting, because one of the sort of fundamental sets of values which we might link to a notion of European culture is around democratic values of tolerance, respect for minorities. It's the sort of all summed up a little bit in the kind of second Copenhagen, 1993 Copenhagen criteria about the sort of democratic conditionality, but that really is a sort of reflection of the sort of democratic values that underpin the European Union, and were even in a beginning way laid out in the treaty of Rome. So I wonder if we could ask you to say something about that. Perhaps I could take one more question, and we won't forget you. Don't worry. We'll come back to you. Should we take one more question from the floor at this point, and then we'll ask our panelists to comment? Who would like to ask the question? Okay, then. Give you some thinking time. In the meantime, Simona, why don't you go straight to that question?
On Serbia was Russian. I was not linking the two together. Actually, it was in the 14th century, while instead this narrative has emerged recently. And Romania case as well as that. On the case of the church in Poland, Marodi has been studying it and the way it has changed at the institutional level and across believers. And actually, the church had been sending letters to priests on the day of the referendum, and that's why also, because the referendum was taken on 2 days, and then generally there's always these studies they look at turnout, and time when turnout is highest in Poland is generally after leaving the church, the religious service on Sunday. I know from my research and research that has been done by Markovsky that some priests didn't read these letters during the religious service. But I don't know whether there was this sort of bargaining and this sort of agreement on. But there was resistance across the most religious circles against European integration, because there was this idea that we are becoming Mafos groups as well, we are becoming like France, or we are becoming like Germany, and there was this idea that we are different from them, and this idea that Poland has been the martyr of Europe and has joined Europe in order to bring the history of Europe together. So that was also in the narrative in the 18th century as well. So there was a religious idea where the civilization of choice was going back to Europe, but it was also Poland that was bringing civilization into Europe. The other one on the expectations doesn't work in Poland, because the expectations were really low. So Poland was joining the European Union, where in the country there was a narrative that was a second-class membership. There was this idea that prices were going to increase. Actually, they increased, but not as high as the expectation were. And there was this idea that we're joining the European Union from the 1st of May, but they were starting to pay from the 1st of January. And funds were coming in shares as well, where, for instance, in particular for farmers, were coming in 2006, but just 25% till reaching 2011 when they have full funds. So the idea that membership was actually then bringing benefits was quite moderate. And actually, it was found that just before joining the European Union, there were more fears than hopes towards EU membership. This has created a situation where actually benefits materialize quite quickly, and therefore you have these islands of support.
Yeah, just on the question about the islands of support for the EU in Poland, what was really interesting in the study of the euro crisis is this idea that that was present in the debate about EU accession in Poland, about a kind of return to Europe, overcoming marginalization on the periphery of Europe, was very much present in the way that the euro crisis was discussed in Poland. So particularly in 2011, when you had discussion about Poland's participation in the fiscal compact and in bailouts and in further kind of pooling of sovereignty, it was very much about ensuring that Poland remained in the core of Europe. So there was a lot of concern at that time that decision making was taking place in the Eurogroup, which would then of course exclude Poland from this key decision making. So you had pro-European media and the civic platform governments at the time very much talking about putting Poland in the heart of Europe to overcome marginalization. Also, what's really interesting is that this idea of Poland as a bulwark or the martyr of Europe also comes into the Euro crisis debates. So at the time, Sikorski, the foreign minister of Poland, was very active in pushing for Polish participation in Eurogroup meetings and things like that. And he, in 2011, made kind of a big speech also about the role of Germany in the crisis. And he was very much in the Polish press presented as like the defender of Western Europe and the common European good. And so it was this idea that Poland is then kind of bringing something to the European Union in terms of kind of protecting the European project. So I think what's really interesting for me is how these historical narratives get reproduced. Of course, we've had a change of government since then, so.
Thank you. Alexander.
Yes. Thank you so much, Claire, for the question. And I think it's a very good question, and I think possibly central to my paper. I think that in a way I'm challenging these ideas that European identity is inherently good and positive because it's cosmopolitan and because it goes beyond the nation. And you know, as Weiler said, we will have this this identity that is no longer based on the pre-political elements or the Habermasian idea of civic constitutional packages. Sorry. So yes, that's very much what normative kind of analysis of European of ideas about European identity, European identification tell us. I would say that when we look to the data, it's not exactly what we find. Mm. So that's where my paper comes in, to challenge this kind of very optimistic and kind of idealistic idea that when we will come together, when we will go beyond this obsession with national identification. education, everything will become better, right? Because we will become more tolerant, and you know, there will be more tolerance for diversity. As you said, this is one of the foundational values of the European Union. However, when you look to the kind of personally rooted attitudes, to the individual level of identification, well, the ideas that people hold are very different, or are kind of different from that. So I think that it also a good example here, I think, is the notion of European citizenship. When you think about it in theory, it's a great idea to have European citizenship, but when you think about who's excluded from that, it actually can contribute to a development of more negative attitudes or notions about those that are from, not from the Europe, not from Europe, not from from the EU, this kind of second or even third class citizens, because second class citizens are the Central Eastern Europeans, or at least they think they are, because we can talk about it. I think it's a very interesting debate about how what you found in the research saying that there is this fear of being marginalized or kind of left out, but right now this is exactly what's happening in Poland, so I wonder, like, what are your thoughts on that? Also, how it happened that coming from a discourse that was very strongly preoccupied with this possibility, then we are exactly in this situation. So sorry, that was just a kind of a detour too, because I was really interested to see to hear what you think about that, this most recent change. But yes, going back to your question, I think in a way my paper is a challenge to that notion and to that idea, and that's what I would like to speak to. So yeah.
Great, thank you. Would anyone else like to ask a question, or Charlotte, would you like to in the answer?
Unless someone else has a question, I might come back to you. Okay. Well, firstly, I wanted to come to your idea of this idea of whether European identity is automatically a kind of good thing, mm-hmm. and that it can also be exclusionary. And I think that's something that came out of my data, even internally, in terms of that there's this Northern European identity that has come out of the crisis discourse that is puts countries like Germany, Poland, actually, the Netherlands, Scandinavia into this category of the good, responsible countries, and but rests very heavily on stereotypes of Southern Europe, the pigs countries, the lazy Southern Europeans. And I think that also fits into what you're saying about European identity also being exclusionary. With Poland, I don't want to say too much about what the current situation, given that my data kind of ends in 2011-2012, but what was very clear is that the discourse in Poland was always very polarized. And so on the one hand, you had this discourse about return to Europe and the pro-Europeans kind of calling for an active role for Poland in the European Union. But on the other hand, this was very heavily contested at that time by peace more conservative newspapers. And that was very much a narrative about Poland being the victim of Germany and German kind of economic power in Europe. And I think the change of government kind of shift the balance to that kind of narrative, and that's very much drawing on notions about Polish sovereignty and drawing heavily on Polish historical memory to the solidarity movement and Polish independence. So actually, I don't find it too surprising.
Was any of the panelists have a question for other members of the panel? And if not, perhaps you would like to comment about what your research might tell us about Brexit, which I know is really unfair to ask you to comment on that when the paper's on Central Eastern Europe. Well, on Europe, it's on EU member states, and we currently asked a member of the EU, so I don't know if you've thought about the sort of Brexit context in the context of the research. research and the sort of theoretical claims you've been pursuing. Yeah.
I was actually thinking about that on my way here, that there was one point about the UK that I wanted to highlight. I didn't go into showing the data country by country, but actually the UK, together with Spain, are the countries where you find the smallest percentage of preference for internal migrants over external migrants. But the roots of that are very different. While in Spain, basically, you have very favorable attitudes towards all kinds of migration. So the difference is not big, because basically most people are basically in favor of both of internal and external migration. However, in the UK, it's very interesting. It has one of the highest percentages of favorable attitudes towards external migration, the non-EU migrants, and one of the lowest towards the internal migration. So I think it illustrates very well. It's a complete outlier comparing to the rest of the countries. And when you connect that to European, to the notion of European identity or European collective identity, I think, I mean, this is not a shocker, this is not surprising. People who have been studying European identity know that, or European identification, I should say. So those of us who look at the individual attitudes in these terms, the UK always has been an outlier in these terms, in terms of how European identification is rooted in national identification. But I think this is another, I would like to present it as such, validation of my study, because if UK in these terms is an outlier, it shows us that the country that actually is always on the low in terms of European identity indicators is also responding in the same way when we look at the kind of the limitation of the community towards the others, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be my 5 cents on that.
Thank you. Any comments?
I feel like all I ever talk about these days is Brexit. I have some thoughts. I would say two things. One about kind of explaining some of the UK discourse, but also in terms of perceptions of Brexit outside the UK. So in terms of my study on the euro crisis, I think it's quite interesting because I would actually use this to explain in some way some of the kind of discourse about the crisis. So what I found is that the understand kind of perceptions of the cause of the crisis are very much linked to how people view the EU and national European identity, and that helps to interpret what the euro crisis actually means. And in the UK, we had a very strong narrative that the euro crisis kind of proves what we thought we knew about the euro all along, that it was a flawed project, it was a terrible idea, and the crisis kind of proves that. And the problem then becomes that, whereas when we joined the EU, this was very much an economic argument. The EU was doing a lot, the EC was doing a lot better economically than the UK, so it was quite an easy argument to make that there's an economic rationale. But after the euro crisis, we've had decades of only using economic arguments to justify European integration, and that then falls away when the euro crisis is interpreted as kind of a sign that the project is flawed. So I've been working on a project that looks at transnational perceptions of Brexit, and what I found in Germany is that the way that the crisis is, the way that Brexit is represented still reflects these same discourses, that it's seen as a kind of existential threat for the European project, and that it threatens, or that Germany has to kind of step up to its historical responsibilities and keep the EU27 together. And I think we've kind of seen a shift in public opinion in the EU towards European integration, and I think that has a lot to do with constructing constructing Brexit in that way.
My comment follows from my current research also on Euroscepticism in my free time. The contribution I wrote, for instance, for the LSE Brexit blog, where I was looking at Euroscepticism and the way that it has become more mainstream and across all the different national narratives, but it has different roots. So
also in the same country, for instance, Greece recently has been a good example. It can be on the extreme right, it can be on the left, so it can be opposition towards this idea of auto-liberal Europe or against Germany, or it can be opposition towards identity and values, as for instance it has been in Poland before joining the European Union. So across different countries, in a way, the crisis has affected attitudes and has, in a way, polarized attitudes towards different types of Euroscepticism, where a soft what for political parties is soft Euroscepticism has become also what John Fitzgibbon calls for civil society Euro-alternativism, that is support for the European Union, but opposition for the process of European integration as it is now. And this may take different determinants or may have different determinants.
Well, I think our time is up. First of all, I'd like to start by thanking Lisi and Alexandra for all they've done to make this fascinating panel discussion happen. I'd like to thank our panel presenters for their very rich insights into their research and also for so graciously answering such a variety of questions. So thank you all very much.